Testing. There? There we are. Okay. You know how often at the beginning of an event people will say, and if you would, check your cell phones and make sure they're turned off. It's sort of a typical thing to do. You don't need to do that today. But, I mean, you can, certainly, right? That does happen to us at times. But I feel like with our new carpet, we need to get up and say every day, would you lean down and check to make sure your water bottles are closed and that the caps are on your coffee? Isn't it wonderful that we have this new carpet in here? I am so thrilled for that. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks to Paul and Shannon and MSG and all who are making that happen. And thanks to Gina and Rachel and the committee who are making this kitchen happen. It is good news. And we are close to not having, you know, ladders and tables and random cords in our auditorium for worship. Hey, at least we don't have it up front today, right? That is something. All right. And one more bit of housekeeping. I was going to say, Lisa and I are going to be out next week, so I won't be here. Thanks to all those who are stepping in to make service run next Sunday. So if this week, if you happen to email me or text me and I don't reply, it's nothing personal, I promise you. I will reply when my vacation's over. So just to let you know, I'll be out next week. Okay, our gospel passage for today. Herod was deeply grieved. Yet out of regard for his oaths and guests, he did not want to refuse the girl. So the king sent a soldier with orders to bring John's head. The soldier went and beheaded John in prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to her. Once upon a time, there was a man named Aristobulus. Now, Aristobulus is not central to our story, but he is at the beginning of it. For you see, Aristobulus had a father, a ruthless and terrible man, whose name was, for all the wrong reasons, Herod the Great. And Aristobulus had a brother, who was also named Herod, Herod Antipas. And Aristobulus had another brother, again named Herod, Herod Philip. It's like the Newhart show in this family. Hi, I'm Larry. This is my brother Daryl and my other brother Daryl. You have to be of an age to understand that, don't you? I saw reruns of that show. I didn't see it live. And so, when Aristobulus had a child, a daughter, in an effort to carry forward the family tradition, he named her, can you guess? Herodias. Now, Aristobulus died in 7 BC. His fearsome father died a few years later in 4 BC. Again, neither of them are main characters in our story, but the brothers Herod and their niece Herodias most certainly are. Indeed, it is this terrible triad of Herods who are at the heart of our tragic tale this morning. You see, when Daddy Herod died, Herod the Great, that is, the Romans split his kingdom into four territories and gave them to his children. Side note, Herod actually had 14 children with no less than 10 different wives, but the rest of them are not important to our story this morning. Now, the four children who inherited Herod the Great's territories. Well, these four children, they were not like, say, the four Metcalf children, or the four Reed kids, or the four Nielsen siblings. These kids did not take care of one another. They did not get along. They didn't even tolerate one another. For these were Herod's. And the Herod kids took after their father, unscrupulous and untethered to any sense of conventional morality. As such, the children were insanely jealous of one another. They were rivals of each other, and they were eager to steal what the other ones had. And so, they plotted against one another. Which is why, when Aristobulus died, his brother Herod Philip swooped in to claim his riches, and did so by marrying Aristobulus's daughter, Herodias, his niece. Now, marrying one's niece wasn't unheard of in this day, but neither was it very common. In any case, for Herod Philip, it worked. He consolidated power, and together, Herod Philip and his niece slash wife, Herodias, had a child, a daughter named Salome, who was, of course, his brother's granddaughter. Meanwhile, Aristobulus's other brother, Herod Antipas, the one Jesus would later call that fox, and not in a complimentary way, Herod Antipas married Phasael, the daughter of the king of Nabatea, the kingdom that bordered Galilee just to the east. It was a marriage between rulers to secure peace between their territories, and frankly, it made a lot of sense. Unfortunately, sensibility was not something the Herods were particularly well suited for, as Herod Antipas would demonstrate in short order, by setting his sights on none other than Aristobulus's daughter, Herodias, the same niece his brother Herod Philip had recently married. Now, perhaps it was a power play, perhaps a way to spite his brother, perhaps it was simply a matter of lust. Who knows? But what we do know is this. By setting his sights on... By setting his sights on Herodias, it caused Herod Antipas to promptly divorce his Nabatean princess and lure his brother's wife slash niece, Herodias, away from Philip, which was stupid on a number of levels. On the one hand, it broke ties with his neighbors who promptly declared war against Galilee. On the other hand, it created an incestuous tangle of Herodian drama uncommon in the first century or any other. You see, since Herod Philip refused to divorce his wife slash niece, and since she was not allowed to divorce her uncle slash husband, when Herod Antipas eventually married her, she became, this is Herodias, the first woman in history to wed not just one, but two of her uncles simultaneously. In one fell swoop, she became the wife, the niece, the sister-in-law of two Herods at the very same time. So, Herodias moves in with Herod Antipas, and she brings with her her daughter Salome, which means that Salome, if you can get your mind around this, becomes all at once Herod Antipas's niece, since she is the daughter of his brother Philip, his grandniece, since she was the daughter, her brother Aristobulus's granddaughter, it's hard to keep this in order, and of course his stepdaughter by marriage to his other niece, who is also now his wife. To make it even more complex, Salome was already both the daughter and grandniece of her own father, as well as the daughter and cousin of her mother, being that they are each daughters of two brothers and granddaughters of the same Herod the Great. Okay, have you got all of that, please? We may gossip about scandal in high places today, but rarely has the material been quite this rich for us. So, it is into this twisted tangle of an immoral mess that John the Baptist enters the scene, and precisely where his tragic demise begins. You see, John is a prophet, which means John is a truth teller. His one task on earth is to speak truth into the world wherever he goes. And so he does. regardless of whether he's talking to a commoner or a king or anyone in between. Which means when the religious leaders from Jerusalem come his way, he says, "You brood of vipers." And when the soldiers come his way, he says, "Stop extorting people. Stop accusing people falsely. And just for kicks, stop complaining about your pay." And it also means that when the Tetrarch of Galilee, Herod Antipas, is within earshot, John refuses to hold back and confronts him with his adultery and the havoc he has wreaked on this incestuous family. Now, Scripture doesn't tell us how the soldiers responded to John's words, nor can we be certain what the religious leaders thought of John's words. We do, however, know precisely what King Herod Antipas was thinking when John spoke truth. As Mark puts it, Herod feared John, knowing he was a righteous and holy man, and Herod protected him. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet Herod liked to listen to him. Which, oddly, is precisely why he had him thrown in jail. In his own distorted way, jail was Herod Antipas's means of both placating his new wife slash niece Herodias, who hated the Baptist and his truth-telling, while simultaneously protecting John, putting him in prison, protecting John from his wife slash niece's murderous plots against the prophet. Now, Herodias most certainly did want to kill John the Baptist. However, before we judge her too harshly for her hatred for John, we should at least note this. It was all fine and dandy for Herod Antipas to enjoy John's words. If his conscience ever convicted him to divorce Herodias, he would fare just fine. He is, after all, the ruler of Galilee. But the same could not be said for Herodias. If her uncle slash husband were to divorce her now, what was she supposed to do? She couldn't go back to Herod Philip, of course. In fact, she'd have nowhere to go. And so, she despises John for his preaching and fears the fact that he has her husband's ear. And thus, Mark tells us she wants to kill him, which we learn is precisely what she'll do. At hubby Herod slash Uncle Antipas' birthday banquet, Salome, the daughter-in-law slash niece slash grandniece, comes in to dance for Herod and his guests. And this scene is troubling on a number of levels, not the least of which is this. When Mark describes Salome, he doesn't use any of the relational terms I've been using. Rather, he simply calls her Corasion. Corasion, the exact same word Mark used 2 weeks ago to describe Jairus' 12-year-old child. It means, quite literally, little girl. Minerva, when you said your prayer today, I heard the Corazon of this little girl. Protect her, Lord, from evil people. When this young child comes in to dance, she dances so well. Pleases her stepfather, slash uncle, slash great uncle Herod and his guests so greatly that the tetrarch, presumably drunk, offers her a rather rash boon. Anything she wants, up to half of his kingdom. And the sickening feeling such a perverse scene leaves in one's stomach only grows worse when we hear what comes next. Herodias, seizing her chance, instructs the young girl to ask for the head of John the Baptist, which Salome does, appending on her own, I might add, the gruesome detail that this grisly gift of a head should be presented on a platter, which, unsurprisingly, sobers Herod almost instantly. He knows, of course, that it is wrong to behead the Baptist, and Mark tells us he doesn't want to do it. But with the usual vanity of kings, he lives in fear. Fear of losing face, fear of embarrassment, fear of seeming sympathetic to a lowly rabble-rouser who lives in his dungeon. And so, Herod, who is in fact the most powerful person in the room, somehow appears today to be the weakest and assents to the dastardly deed and has John the Baptist executed. He dies for a dance. And so, our story ends as John's disciples take his lifeless, headless body away, laying it in a tomb. And this grotesque family goes on with life as normal, perversely normal. So, why has Mark shared this story with us? Why tell it once again today? Curiously, Mark doesn't say. He simply leaves it without comment. According to Matthew's gospel, when Jesus hears of John's death, he is so shaken, he departs in a boat, as Matthew puts it, to a lonely place and grieves. And today, I'd like you to sit with that description for just a moment. When Jesus hears the story I've just shared with you, a parable of sorts, of our own convoluted world, this is not simply about the Herods, of course. This is a parable about the horrors we humans are capable of. Notice that the one thing Jesus doesn't do when he hears that news is preach. He doesn't turn this horror story into a morality tale of any sort. He doesn't attempt to minimize the misery or lessen the loss in any way by saying it's all going to be okay. Rather, Jesus withdraws into silence. He mourns. He lingers over his pain, and he creates some space for it to spend itself. Which suggests to me that perhaps the point of this story, the point of Mark sharing it without commentary, and the point of Jesus' silence in response to it, is that sometimes it's probably actually best if we don't slap meaning and purpose onto every human experience we encounter. For some human hurts simply cannot be salvaged with a tidy point or a bright bow. And perhaps the best thing to do in those moments is just what Mark does, and simply tell the story, acknowledge the tragedy, remember and honor those who have suffered, and like Jesus, simply mourn. And though I can't tell you exactly why, I, for one, find that incredibly healing. But note this as well. After Jesus has sought out his solitude, lived with his pain, grieved his loss, the very next thing he does, in both Matthew's gospel and in Mark's, the very next thing he does is turn around and feed people. Which tells me this, that while it is our task to honor silence, create space for grief, mourn freely, when we're ready, we are also tasked with turning back toward our neighbors in whatever capacity we have available and caring for one another in our needs, trusting that somehow, some way, what we can offer in this tragic world will be enough, even if we can't explain why or how. You know, to be honest, I looked over at Lisa when the passage was done being read and felt the difficulty of everyone saying, "Thanks be to God." But now that I think about it, I'm glad we did. Because it's our reminder that God doesn't ask us to pretend that tragedy and evil don't exist. Rather, God invites us to acknowledge them, as Mark did, to mourn them, as Christ did, and when we're able, to return to our neighbors and offer what we can, just like Jesus. And if that's the point, well, then I gladly say, the word of the Lord, thanks be to God. Amen.